Imagine this. You've just achieved the impossible.
Like the ultimate fantasy scenario.
Right. You track down this mastermind monster that's been terrorizing the region. You killed it. You ended a bitter war. And you saved a group of hostages who had been magically transformed into beasts.
Which is a massive victory. By any standard metric, you should be taking a victory lap.
Oh, absolutely. But now comes the actual hard part. You have to walk into a city full of deeply prejudiced, heavily armed people and somehow convince them that their entire worldview for the last few decades has been, well, completely wrong.
Yeah, that is the ultimate crisis communication scenario. The physical battle with the monster is over, but, you know, the battle for the public narrative is just beginning.
And it's arguably far more dangerous.
Oh, 100%.
And that is exactly what we're unpacking today. Welcome to the Deep Dive. We are looking into this intricate set of logs from an online role-playing campaign called Mirari.
And before you, listening, think this is just some basic fantasy game recap, stick with us.
Seriously, stick with us. Because what's buried in these session logs is just this absolute masterclass in public relations, the psychology of prejudice, and how history is actively manufactured.
Or as they spell it in this world, history. It serves as a brilliant sociological case study.
It really does.
We're basically watching these characters navigate this incredibly messy, volatile aftermath, a major conflict. We get to see them engineer a peace treaty in real time.
Yeah, so let's introduce the team quickly so you know who the players are on this geopolitical chessboard.
Good call.
First, we have Redmayne. She's a non-Fey knight, so she's this outsider constantly fighting for respect in a highly prejudiced aristocratic system.
Right. She has to work twice as hard.
Exactly. Then there's Thomas, the eccentric lord explorer. He uses humor and acting like a buffoon, almost like a weapon.
He's fascinating.
Then we've got Lord December, this stoic, commanding noble who really understands the mechanics of power. There's Bravel, a pragmatic, giant veteran knight. And finally, Erzsebet, a literal wolf woman who was, until very recently, on the opposing side of the war.
The enemy, basically. And the central mission of our deep dive today is to deconstruct how these very different characters actually build peace.
Because it doesn't just start with a big speech, right?
Exactly. The source material illustrates so clearly that before you can address a hostile army, peace has to start at the micro level. It begins in quiet, awkward, personal interactions.
Long before it could ever be scaled up to public policy.
Right.
Okay, so let's unpack that micro level first. We need to look at this hospital room scene, because this is where the foundational blueprint for everything else gets drafted.
The setting here is so important.
Yeah. Picture this crumbling ancient medical building. Erzsebet, the wolf woman, is recovering on a cold stone bed. And sitting on the dusty floor right next to her, personally trying to feed her a bowl of stew, is Lord December.
Just consider the visual contrast there. You have this formal, imposing lord of a great house abandoning all protocol.
Just sitting in the dirt.
Exactly. Sitting in the dirt, performing the intimate labor of a nurse for someone the rest of his society considers a monster. The psychology of stepping out of the hierarchy like that is profound.
It disrupts everything she thought she knew about him.
It immediately breaks down her outgroup bias.
Well, and it also leads to this incredibly funny, humanizing moment. Erzsebet isn't hungry, and she's refusing to eat. So Lord December, using his very grave, serious, commanding voice, threatens her.
Oh, this part is gold.
He literally tells her, if you continue to refuse, I will be forced to do the butterfly.
Which causes absolute, utter confusion in the room.
Complete bewilderment. Erzsebet has no idea what he's talking about. Redmayne, the battle-hardened knight, literally thinks he means running out into the freezing snow to catch insects in their mouths.
Right. The tension is palpable.
It is. Until Bravel, the giant veteran, just deadpans to everyone that the butterfly is the classic parent trick where you fly a spoon around like an airplane to trick a toddler into opening their mouth.
If we break down the sociological function of that specific joke, it's brilliant. By introducing this universally recognized, almost silly domestic concept of feeding a stubborn child, the hostility evaporates.
It totally diffuses the room.
It forces a reset. Lord December is no longer just the stoic, terrifying Fey Lord. He's a guy willing to look a little goofy to help someone heal.
Yeah.
It creates cognitive dissonance for Ertzibet. I mean, you cannot maintain a blood feud with a man who is making airplane noises with a spoon.
You really can't. It is the ultimate grassroots diplomacy. If you've ever seen, like, a Fortune 500 CEO put on a hairnet and work the assembly line for a day, you know how quickly that builds credibility.
Exactly like that.
But he takes it a step further. He doesn't just feed her. He makes a very calculated political offer. He invites her to come back to his castle.
A move that he frames very deliberately. Ertzibet naturally assumes he's proposing a political marriage.
Which makes sense, right? That's the historical playbook for uniting warring factions.
Right, for centuries. But Lord December explicitly rejects that premise. He refuses to bear a political marriage. Instead, he offers her the position of his second in command.
Wow.
He wants her as a hunting partner, a professional equal. He's proving that systemic integration has to start with genuine, merit-based respect, not just a tactical, forced alliance.
Okay, let me pause you there, though, because that feels a bit too optimistic, doesn't it? Can a personal relationship forged over a bowl of stew truly override deeply ingrained systemic prejudice?
That's a very fair pushback.
I ask because Thomas, our eccentric Lord Explorer, points out a really harsh reality in this exact same scene. Redmayne is still facing intense bigotry from the other knights, simply for being non-fey. So clearly, personal diplomacy has its limits.
It does. And Thomas is acutely aware of those limits. This is where we see that Thomas hides a deeply Machiavellian political mind behind his eccentric exterior.
Yeah, he's sharper than he looks.
Much sharper. When the group discusses how to report this massive victory to the public, Thomas insists, unequivocally, that Redmayne must take the official credit for resolving the crisis.
Even though Lord December's diplomacy is what ultimately sealed the peace with the wolves.
Precisely. Thomas understands the mechanics of bigotry better than anyone. He knows Redmayne is fighting a daily battle just to be judged fairly by the Fey establishment.
So he uses the victory for her.
Exactly. By forcing her into the spotlight as the undisputed savior of the realm, he's manipulating the prejudiced public. He's forcing them to judge her on her undeniable monumental success rather than her background.
He's basically managing her brand.
Yes, artificially elevating her status to a level where the daily bigotry simply cannot reach her anymore.
So he's weaponizing her success to shield her from racism. That is a fascinating strategy.
Yeah.
But grassroots diplomacy and brand management in a private infirmary have a severe limitation.
They don't scale.
Right, they don't scale. To manufacture peace for thousands of panicked armed citizens, you have to shift from personal authenticity to deliberate public manipulation.
And that transition happens on the brutal journey back to the city of Lunafell. This is where the concept of history really comes into play.
It's so interesting to see it play out.
We get to see exactly how the official historical record is actively constructed.
The scene itself is wonderfully visceral, too. Redmayne and Bravel are exhausted, literally dragging the severed head of the mastermind monster through the snow.
Such a grim image.
It is. And Redmayne notes that the black goo leaking from the head is squamish, which is such a perfectly gross tactile detail. Meanwhile, Thomas is scouting ahead specifically because he wants to avoid stuffy people.
Classic Thomas. But during this grueling physical labor, Bravel gives Redmayne a history lesson that completely recontextualizes the world they're living in.
Oh, this part blew my mind.
Right. He explains the origins of the bitter feud between the House of December and the House of May.
Because if you're reading a grand fantasy epic, you assume a generational blood feud starts over, like a stolen magical artifact, or an assassination, or a usurped throne.
Something epic.
Right. But Breville explains it started over moldy grain shipments.
A mundane trade agreement felt slightly unfair. Some merchant caravans arrive with tainted grain, and suddenly psychological paranoia takes the wheel.
It's so petty.
But that's how it happens. People start claiming the mold was an intentional poisoning meant to soften them up for an invasion. It perfectly illustrates how massive systemic hatreds rarely start with cinematic betrayals.
They stem from incredibly boring misunderstandings.
Exactly. Misunderstandings that leaders allow to fester into full-blown conspiracy theories.
Think about how easily that happens today in our own information ecosystems. I mean, a minor misquote spirals into a massive scandal overnight.
Oh, absolutely.
So, keeping that extreme paranoia in mind, let's look at Lord December's PR strategy for when they finally arrive back at the city. He's very aware of how quickly a crowd can turn into a mob.
He is. His first move is to order his own surviving soldiers to remain absolutely silent about their ordeal. He imposes a strict military gag order on the survivors.
And when Redmayne asks him what she should tell the people, Lord December hands her a very specific, highly edited script.
A very careful narrative.
Yeah, he tells her to focus entirely on the ancient, forgotten alliance between the Fae and the Wolves. He tells her to hold up the monster's head as proof that they had a common enemy.
But crucially, he instructs her to completely omit the fact that this monster was actually part of a much larger, lingering plot.
He deliberately chooses to hide the ongoing threat from his own people, which honestly feels exactly like modern corporate speak.
It really does.
Like, if you've ever been in a company meeting where management restructures the timeline of a failing project to prevent a mass exodus of employees, you recognize this tactic.
Yeah, you're managing panic.
But here's my question. Isn't there a massive strategic risk in hiding a lingering threat? If the public thinks the danger is over, they let their guard down. Why wouldn't a leader want his people vigilant?
It comes down to managing the cognitive load of a traumatized populace. Lord December is exercising the pure pragmatism of leadership. He knows his people are exhausted and terrified.
They can't handle more bad news.
Right. If he drops a complex, ongoing conspiracy theory on them, revealing that there are potential traitors still out there working with unknown forces, the fragile peace process will shatter instantly.
Ah, I see.
The paranoia over the moldy grain will look like a warm-up. The mob will panic and immediately turn their weapons back on the Wolves.
So they literally cannot process the nuance of an ongoing investigation right now. They need a definitive ending.
They need a neat narrative, Bo. What this source material demonstrates is that history isn't an objective recording of facts. It's an algorithm.
It's curated.
It's actively shaped by what a leader chooses to speak into existence, and just as importantly, what they filter out to prevent cognitive overload. By omitting the lingering plot, Lord December gives the public the psychological closure they need to stop fighting.
Okay, so the leaders are engineering this macro-level public narrative. But while they're outlining the big speech, someone has to manage the immediate raw trauma of the victims who actually lived through the horror.
The ones on the ground.
Yeah, because back in a makeshift camp, there's a group of Fae who had been forcibly transformed into wolves, fitted with collars, and used as weapons.
Which is horrifying.
It's awful. They're now sitting in the dirt, eating meager supplies, locked in their own heads, trying to process the absolute violation of what just happened to them.
And this brings us back to Thomas, who executes one of the most brilliant displays of psychological diffusion I have seen in a narrative like this.
Picture this scene. These victims are traumatized, they're confused, the tension is suffocating, and Thomas steps right into the center of the camp and starts loudly telling an incredibly cheesy, exaggerated story.
He makes a complete spectacle of himself.
He does. He claims he was used as human bait for a giant sea dragon. He rolls around in imaginary fish entrails, mimes getting shot out of a ballista, and proudly announces to the entire camp that the title of this epic tale is The Worm Felled by a Worm.
A title he fiercely defends against his alternative option, which was Dope on a Rope.
Exactly the kind of terrible dad joke that makes you wince. And the traumatized Fae respond by groaning loudly and literally pelting him with their travel bags and handfuls of dirt.
Right.
Now, my initial reaction to reading this was intense skepticism. If I'm in that camp, newly human again, dealing with severe PTSD, I want a therapist.
Yeah, you want quiet.
I want a warm blanket and quiet time. I do not want a stand-up comedian making my survival about his ego. Is he just a selfish clown who can't read the room?
It looks entirely inappropriate on the surface. Mm-hmm. But if we analyze the physiological and psychological outcome, Thomas is actually performing a highly effective trauma intervention.
Really?
Yes, he's intentionally taking on the archetype of the fool.
How does acting like a fool help someone with PTSD?
Well, when people survive a severe trauma, their sympathetic nervous system is often locked in a state of hypervigilance. They're stuck in fight, flight, or freeze.
Okay.
By making himself completely ridiculous, by telling a joke so bad that it begs for a collective groan, Thomas acts as a pressure release valve. He gives them a safe, low-stakes target for their pent-up kinetic energy.
Oh, the throwing bags.
Exactly. Throwing those bags at him is a physical, somatic release. It tricks their nervous systems out of the freeze response and forces them into a shared communal action. He makes them smile despite the horror.
He physically breaks the ice of their trauma. That totally reframes how I looked at that scene.
And the timing of what happens next proves the strategy. Right after that tension is broken, before they can put their walls back up, Redmayne steps in and asks the victims the hardest possible question.
The big one.
How do you feel about the wolves now? Will you be able to coexist with the people who are just hunting you?
And their response is profound. Because they aren't blinded by anger in that specific moment. Because the tension was diffused by Thomas, they're able to access genuine empathy.
Which is incredible given what they just went through.
It is. One of the young men says that while he was trapped in the mind of a wolf, he saw that the pack wasn't evil. They were just scared, starving, and dying out.
Wow.
Yeah. And another victim says he's willing to give peace a chance as long as trust is actively earned. They recognize the shared survival instinct of their former enemies.
Thomas had to soften the psychological ground so Redmayne could plant those seeds of reconciliation. You cannot force traumatized people to sign a peace treaty if they're still physiologically clenching their fists.
You just can't. Which sets the stage perfectly for the absolute climax of this deep dive. With the victims personally on board and the historical narrative meticulously edited and planned, Redmayne has to face the ultimate test. Yes. They finally arrive at the gates of the city of Lunafell. And immediately, the atmosphere is electric with hostility. An officer at the gate starts insulting Redmayne to her face.
Right away.
Yeah. Lord December steps in, shuts the officer down, and demands respect for her. But the tension is thick enough to cut with a knife.
This is the crucible. Redmayne has to climb up to the wall rampart and deliver her carefully crafted speech to rows of highly suspicious soldiers and terrified townsfolk.
If you've ever had to give a presentation to a room full of people who actively want you to fail, multiply that feeling by 1,000.
It's a nightmare scenario.
It's like walking into a hostile shareholder meeting where everyone is holding drawn bows and arrows, but she doesn't walk up to the podium, clear her throat, and ask for quiet.
No, she does not.
She takes her steel sword and violently plunges it right back into the original fatal wound on the monster's severed head, pinning it to the stone wall for everyone to see.
It is a breathtaking piece of political theater. She bypasses logical debate entirely and speaks directly to their primal brains.
It's such a power move.
It really is. It establishes absolute physical dominance and provides undeniable, grotesque proof of her claims before she even says a single word.
It completely silences the mob.
Mm-hmm.
And then she executes Lord December's PR plan flawlessly. She weaves the narrative of the ancient alliance. She frames the monster as the ultimate manipulator who tricked both sides into a pointless war.
But here's where things go sideways.
Right. During the speech, that hostile officer from the gate interrupts her in front of everyone. He loudly accuses her of siding with the enemy because she had temporarily been transformed into a wolf herself.
He tries to undermine her entirely.
Yeah, and she doesn't just use logic or evidence to debate him. Instead, she yells at the crowd to look at Lord December, praising his unparalleled courage for facing this bitter new truth without flinching.
It's such a pivot.
So I have to ask, did she actually win that crowd over with facts, or did she just win by being the loudest alpha in the room?
What makes this the climax of our deep dive is that it was a masterstroke of both. She absolutely appealed to their intellect with the physical proof of the head. And she appealed to their emotions by highlighting the safe return of the transformed hostages. But her true genius, the real political science at play here, was how she weaponized authority.
Walk me through the mechanics of that. How does praising the boss neutralize the hostile officer?
By loudly praising Lord December's courage in accepting this new peaceful reality, she set an inescapable behavioral trap for the dissenting soldiers.
A trap?
Yes. The hostile officer was trying to turn the crowd against Redmayne, the outsider. But Redmayne instantly tethered her narrative directly to the honor of their lord.
Oh, I see.
Suddenly, for that officer or any soldier to disagree with Redmayne's story, they weren't just arguing with a foreign knight. They were publicly questioning the courage, judgment, and honor of Lord December himself.
Oh, that is brilliant. She boxed them into a corner. You cannot call her a liar without implicitly calling your own commanding officer a gullible coward.
Exactly. She used physical theater to command attention. She used curated facts to build the acceptable narrative. And she used immense political leverage to silence dissent.
It's textbook.
It's a textbook execution of high-stakes crisis communication. She made it more dangerous for them to disagree with her than to accept the new peace.
And it works. The crowd disperses without firing a single arrow. The adrenaline finally wears off, and our heroes get to retreat to the local tavern to decompress from a week of literally reshaping reality.
But the sources give us a few lingering, quiet moments that beautifully ground this massive geopolitical narrative before we finish.
The aftermath is so telling. Before Redmayne even steps foot into the tavern, she's stopped by this tiny little fae girl with charcoal black hair.
This part is so sweet.
The girl just wraps her arms around Redman's leg and quietly thanks her for bringing her brother home. It's this incredibly poignant reminder that amidst all the Machiavellian political maneuvering, the PR spin, the constructed histories, the stakes are intensely personal.
Real families were saved from a nightmare.
Yeah.
It anchors the macro-level political theory right back to the micro-level humanity where we started the story in the infirmary. It reminds us why the manipulation was necessary.
It really does. And then we get to the tavern. Redmayne sits down with Bravel. They're having a much-deserved beer. And Redmayne starts casually asking about Thomas's romantic viability.
Uh-huh, naturally.
Which is hilarious because she completely deadpans to this giant veteran knight, "I killed my last lover. So I'm not expecting a lot out of Thomas."
Yeah. To which Bravel basically replies, "You know, that doesn't really help your case, right?"
It highlights the deep camaraderie they've built through surviving this crucible.
Yeah.
But the ultimate punchline of the entire source text happens right after this exchange.
The truly unthinkable occurs.
Thomas comes downstairs.
Mm-hmm.
And he is wearing clean clothes. His hair is actually combed. He has, against all odds, taken a bath.
A miracle that arguably rivals the defeat of the mastermind monster itself.
Without a doubt. So what does this all mean for you listening? We have journeyed from a quiet, dusty hospital room to a hostile city wall.
We've covered a lot of ground.
We really have. We've seen how micro-diplomacy, like making an absurd joke about a butterfly, can short-circuit outgroup bias and build a foundation of trust.
And we've seen how perfectly timed humor, even when it involves rolling around in imaginary fish guts, can provide the somatic release necessary to disarm deep trauma.
Exactly. And we've seen how leaders meticulously craft narratives, omitting the messy, lingering threats, to manage the cognitive load of a public and engineer peace.
It proves that dismantling prejudice and ending a conflict isn't just about winning the physical battle. It is entirely about how you strategically construct the story of that victory.
Which leaves us with one final thought for you to ponder. We just watched Redmayne and Lord December completely rewrite the history of their lands, carefully omitting the ongoing conspiracy to create a neat, digestible narrative that prevented a massive riot.
Right.
If the truth we read in our own history books is sometimes just the safest, most algorithmically smooth version of a story designed to keep the peace, how much of your own reality is built on carefully omitted details?